going to have a debate about a letter that was circulated at the camp, which caused all sorts of controversies. We've got a poo diary. I don't even know what that is. I'm not sure if I want to know. We've got something about rocket stoves. We've got another media report. It's going to be jam-packed. It's going to be lovely. Now we've got a food report for you.
So we're here in the West Midlands tent, looking very busy. What's for dinner?
We're going to have a beautiful carrot, swede and potato curry with ginger and garlic.
And on the side?
Whatever we can find in the kitchen.
Okay, and what time do you reckon?
About 7 o'clock.
Okay, cool. Thanks very much.
All right, we're in the Yorkshire Barrio. What are you cooking for dinner?
Hi, we're cooking some kind of Thai curry with lots of eggs and with rice. And rice, I'm telling you, rice for 200 people is really a biggie. But we seem to have managed it quite well up to now.
That sounds delicious. Are you feeling confident about it?
Yeah, quite. I think it's going to be good.
Excellent. And what sort of time are you going to be serving up?
Between 6:30 and 7.
That's great, thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Cheers.
All right, we're here in the east side. What's for dinner?
Thai curry and rice and salad.
Okay, and what time do you reckon the beer ready at?
I don't even know what time it is now.
All right, we'll say around 7 o'clock then. All right, thanks very much.
All right, we're in the Wales kitchen and something's smelling good. What are you cooking for dinner?
We're making some stir fry with quite a random selection of vegetables, basically what we've got left, and flavour's a bit of an issue at the moment, so we're just putting in quite a simple thing that I've never come across before, but it's called bouillon. And we are in need of some more spices, but what the saving grace is this dal idea. We're going to make some dal as well. And that is, the combination is just going to be killer. I can't wait to eat it.
Great stuff, man. So what time do you reckon you're going to be serving up?
6:30 is the aim, and the rate we're going, we're on fire at the moment, and some parts of the food are as well, but it should be already, right, yeah, around about 6:30, that's pretty early.
Yeah. Cool, thanks very much.
Yeah, no problems, man, have a good one.
Right, here in the Northwest neighbourhood, so what's for dinner?
Okay, we've got a very very flexible dinner going on, so we're just going to kind of see what we make of it, but we've got some potatoes and onions going here, then we've got some seeds we just brought over. What else have we got, Ben?
We're going to do some tomato sauce with lots of garlic and onions and that sort of thing, and we're going to do some spuds and some toasted sesame seeds and pumpkin seeds and mix them with spuds and that sort of thing. So add a bit of protein. So seeds are supposed to add a bit of protein. But I'm not going to go overboard with protein and put beans in it because
we've had enough beans already, I think.
Yeah. we're going to try and put this evening.
And what time do you reckon you'll be finished at?
What time? I think it's 7:30, I think, we were telling people, but we might be a bit late because there's a bit of the food order was a bit late this afternoon. So.
All right, well, best of luck with that now.
Cheers.
All right, we're in London. What's for dinner?
We don't know yet.
Okay, you have a very nice cake there.
Yes, it's our very first one in the London camp oven, which is that what looks like a fold-up safe up there is actually an oven, but we don't know how it's going to turn out yet. It looks good and it smells good. Smell?
It does smell good.
It does. But I've no idea what it tastes like. We'll let you know. Maybe we'll update you in about a couple of hours' time.
And are you going to be giving that out to folk for tea?
I reckon, well, yeah, it depends. I've got a few people that have suddenly taken it upon themselves to be bakers for a while. So there's possibly going to be cake after dinner, but probably not enough for the entire London neighbourhood. So the lucky few that are around at the right time in the right place.
All right, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, we're down at the Anarchist Teapot. What are you cooking for dinner?
Coconut curry and rice with salad.
Is it going to be delicious?
It's going to be amazing.
As always. Well, but what sort of time are we looking at having dinner?
7 o'clock.
Cool, thanks very much.
Right, we're here in Oxford Thames Valley. What's for tea?
There's shivvi, tomato-y, spicy, bulgur-y with some fried-up seeds and sultanas and many delicious things, combined with like a sort of coconutty Southeast Asian curry. So it's going to be very exciting, I think.
Seems to be a battle of the curries tonight. There's a lot of kitchens doing curries. How do you feel you'll fare kind of in comparison to the other ones?
I don't think it's even an argument, really. I mean, I think Oxford is clearly on it. You know, we've got some highly experienced curry makers doing their best work here. So I don't know, maybe someone should go to sample each one and see which is best.
I think we might actually do that. But you're looking quite prepared. You're looking fresh, clean, well-rested. So best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
All right, we're down in the Scotland and Newcastle barrio. What are you cooking for dinner?
I think we're having vegetable goulash with courgette and aubergine. And then alongside that, we're having neeps and tatties.
Neeps and tatties, the old classic.
Yeah, you've got to in Scotland, you've got to have it once a week, eh?
Absolutely. We lose all energy without neeps and tatties at some point.
You're missing it.
No, that's just great. We're seeing a lot of curries going down tonight, so a goulash is really rocking the boat.
Yeah. Hungarian Scotch kind of fusion there.
Classic. So what sort of time are you going to be dining?
Well, we started about 2 hours late tonight, I think, because we needed to go and pick up orders of vegetables from up the road, and so I think we'll half seven, something like that.
Oh, best of luck to you.
Thank you.
All right, so Hardy Ben is out doing a bit of food criticizing for us. He's gonna be back in a while with a big full belly full of curry, and he's gonna give us some marks and comments. So stay tuned for that. And right now in the studio we are joined by basically the people who are responsible for powering the entire camp. We have Chan.
Hi there.
Are you just Chan? You're a one man army, or do you have a name for your group? Or
I'm Chan, but I've been working with lots of people over the last week. I've been doing training for the last year for lots of people who've been involved in climate camp, and they've all been learning new skills, helping me.
Okay, and we got Darren from Caltech.
Hi.
And we got the infamous, the strikingly handsome, the one, the only Raimundo.
Oh, what a welcome, thanks.
Cheers. So,
All right, guys, so, for instance, us here, we're running live in the studio, and we're getting power, and rather than getting it from fossil fuels, we're actually, most of this energy's come from the sun. So, each of you sort of have your own separate systems. Who are we running off tonight?
Oh, that's me.
That's you. Just to say thanks, first of all.
Yeah.
We appreciate that.
Great stuff.
Cheers. So where we are actually is where a lot of the power seems to be collected on site, or at least a portion of it. So how exactly are you collecting power for use today?
Well, most of it's come off the sun, but as you know, it's been like a reasonably shitty day for solar charging. Unlike yesterday, of course. But we've been doing the power.
And so from around here, a lot of it is coming from solar. And do we have any other sources going on site?
We've got the large generator X truck that's providing the electricity even for most of the central infrastructure on the camps. That's the things like comms, legal, medics, site office, and then it's going up to provide entertainment and projectors for workshops as well.
And we've also got a number of wind generators up. There's a new one just gone up today.
The only wind generator that I've got on my system is a hand-built Hugh Piggott wind turbine that's made by V3, who are a cooperative from Nottingham.
Sounds like a bomber plane when you describe it like that. Not really.
And so each of the neighbourhoods also have their own decentralised power coming from solar as well.
That's right. As well as the central systems, each of the neighbourhoods and a lot of places such as the welcome tent, some of the toilets, etc., have their own small systems where we're just using a battery to power a light, maybe a bit of phone charging.
It's really good actually, because over the last few years people have got basically their shit together and started producing power for themselves, which takes some of the pressure off of the power providers.
That's right. We just try and give people advice and training so that they can learn how to...
Turning off lights, unplugging adapters, it's all relevant.
I think we're talking about the general issue of the standby light here, for instance, and the charging light. Like one of the interesting facts I learned actually here at the camp this year is that actually having a laptop plugged in with the battery uses twice as much power.
You're charging the battery as you're using the laptop, so like take the battery out. You know.
And so what are sort of, in relation to doing this, I think this is a very good educational tool for people for when they're at home, right, yeah, in relation to the argument of it's not how much, it's about actually the amount of power we consume. And a lot of the problems we're having at the moment is because we consume so much power, we require so much power, and people are demanding of it. So I think this is very good for trying to reduce people's expectations, perhaps.
Yeah, but the thing is, when people are at home, it's an easy thing because like power's on tap, you know, you can just like go in anywhere in your kitchen, in your bedroom, and just plug in, and like you know you don't really think of it.
Yeah. And here on the camp, we've actually had to sit down and decide,
analyze,
and decide
what
our priorities.
What people are doing,
yeah. We have certain priorities here, such as medics, which could be life threatening, and then obviously legal, which is extremely important. And we've got our communications for our security,
radio,
central kitchens, food store, etc., etc. And we have to decide.
Who gets what and when,
and
really,
for how many hours. This is the point. It's not just how much pay.
It's been a bit
take.
Of a mission for us because we've had to sort of like plan out, because obviously Saturday, Sunday is our big day, so to speak. So we've had to plan out our power and sort of like ration people, unbeknown to us, weather predicaments.
Okay. Yeah, we can never predict the weather or exactly what it is that people are going to require power for.
Yeah, totally.
Well, I noticed that in the systems that are here. For instance, now we've got, as I said, basically three power systems here, and you tend to use a combination of two sources, which is solar and wind. And any of you guys do any hydro stuff? Because someone mentioned to me earlier about different sources of energy, and I suddenly thought of earth, wind, and fire type thing. You know, fire is causing us problems, we're burning everything, but like there's water as well as the sun and the wind.
Very difficult to set up a sort of like a water power providing system on site. Or, you know, it take you a long time to sort of like get it together, and I think it's really sort of like quite unpractical for site living, basically.
And then the nice
thing is you're going to be there for a long time.
I think if you're off the grid and you're living in a place that doesn't have any power at all, then you know hydro is really important. And you can get a reasonable amount of power from hydro. And,
yeah, totally, I agree.
In the right circumstances, you'll get 24/7, you know, you'll get a constant power out of hydro, you know. And they're not expensive. If you consider the cost of a solar panel or a wind turbine, hydro, like in Canada, they make a special little small hydro system, which is 700 watts, costs about £800, and it runs off a sort of 2-inch alkathene sort of flow of water, and it runs through the flow through. So you're guaranteed to have, you know, somewhere in the region of, you know, 75, 80 watts all the time, which is incredible because it's 24/7. You know, it's a lot of power.
All right, cool. So, I mean, these are different ways of doing it. Now, I said, you guys all have, like, systems for powering up vastly more than you would require at home, I dare say. And we talked, two of the bigger systems, but one in particular is actually like a mobile home power system. That's your cell, Raymond.
Mobile it's home. A, I don't like that.
Beautiful here.
Can we call it a
thing?
Rig or something? Or something? Or a truck or something? Or something?
All right, a big ass truck.
Do you know what I mean? It's a
it's a minibus.
Yeah, it's a vehicle which I live in for 6 months of the year when I'm doing projects. You know, so I've came back from spending 3 months in Portugal doing renewables over there, and I live in the vehicle, so it's a live-in vehicle type thing.
But from that vehicle, for instance, you have enough solar panels to provide excess power. So, I mean, what's involved in setting up this type of thing? Because people are very interested in the idea of being able to get mobile with power, which is, I think, the sort of tasks that you, or the sort of services you guys provide. So what sort of things could I get, for instance, that would enable me to have power in a field? I mean, what sort of things should people be looking for?
Well, for first off, you need a battery.
Leisure battery.
Well, any battery will do. Just like find one in a skip, or like people leave them at outside recycle centres. You know, just grab one, stick a multimeter across it. Like if it's good, it's good. You know what I mean? Good to go, basically. You know, it's luck of the find, isn't it?
Especially if you're skipping them, I suppose.
Yeah. But like, you can find reasonable batteries. I've tatted reasonable batteries before, you know, and you can do stuff with them. Even if it's a battery that won't charge up to like a full voltage, you can still run sort of like, if you've got like a 9-watt light bulb, you can still run it off a battery that'll only charge to 9 volts.
I suppose the secret is looking at, first of all, what it is you need it for.
Yeah.
And what kind of amount of power you're going to use, you know. So if you start from reducing the amount of power that you're using, then to a level, like two pieces of equipment can, one might say it uses 80 watts and the other one might say it uses 60 watts. But you can actually check them. You can buy a little sort of meter from, you know, Lidl's or something like that. And it'll give you a power rating, you know, it'll tell you exactly how many watts you'll use. And the interesting thing of that is that it's not often accurate. You know, the appliance that you're looking at might say it's using 400 watts, but actually it might only use 350, or so it's not very accurate. So you just have to start by looking at what you're using and then decide the system you need from that.
So then, like, so you've got your batteries out of the skip. I mean, have any of yous ever, like, skipped a solar panel or a wind generator? You have. Do you want
to... Yeah, we got... well, originally, it was down to the E-team, big up Ian. But he got 6 BPs out of a skip that I think had just come off the roof. You know, they do the garages now, the BP garages. I know it's like bad, totally bad advertising to mention anything to do with power companies.
But we can steal their solar panels.
But like, they do replace their panels, and so like, check the skips.
Okay. But if... If you don't have a BP garage near you, I mean, where's the best place to start if you're looking at
railway lines, water companies.
Right.
There's a lot of these things on the side of the road now, you know what I mean? You can quite easily, like, chop down late at night and stuff, you know.
Okay.
They are there.
They are there.
Keep your eyes out.
Yeah. But if you're wanting to go down kind of maybe less arrestable routes, if you want to start off...
Right, don't go to Maplin's.
Don't go to Maplin's.
Don't go to any of the big shops, because like, they're just like totally unreasonable prices. They're far, far overpriced for what they are.
And try and avoid buying them at festivals as well. You probably want to speak to people who have lots of solar panels.
Yeah. That's what I'm doing right
now.
Such
as these guys here. I mean... Some of the cheaper prices, basically, to get cheap prices, you need to get trade prices. To get trade prices, basically, the trick is to buy in bulk, so maybe get a group of people together and buy in bulk and approach some of the wholesalers. I don't want to plug my own business, but if you approach me, I buy in wholesale, for example, occasionally, and I can buy retail prices anyway.
Okay.
So then caravan shop is a good place to start.
Okay.
No, I think they're totally overpriced, to be honest with you.
40 quid for 80 amp battery. Leisure battery.
Yeah, batteries maybe they might be good for, but I don't think the price on panels is good.
So, get a battery by hook or by crook, a panel by hook or by crook.
And you need a regulator also.
Well, we don't use it. A lot of the time we don't use regulators, you know.
Yeah, we don't use regulators, but the general public need to use regulators, you know.
Well,
the debate on levels of equipment.
If you're clued up or not, you know, I mean, if your battery's flat, you know, put what you need into it direct from the sun, like, don't go through a regulator, you know, and just keep your eye on it.
Well,
as long as you don't take it over, like, 14 or 15 volts, like, you'd be like, you know, yeah, that's cool.
I think just to explain, a regulator is there designed to stop the battery from being drained.
Overcharged.
Too much.
Overcharged,
or whatever. So that's very important for the duration and life of a battery. So
yeah, if you've got a solar panel on your roof of your van or something with a battery in it that's on charge constantly, then yeah, probably a regulator is a good idea. But like, if you're going to use a battery that night that you've, you know, gone up from flat in the day, it's, you know, I wouldn't put a regulator on.
That's how I started, was with batteries that I found on the street and some solar panels that were given away. The university had them. They were prototype panels. They were degraded in the sunlight because they were a very, very poor design. You know, they're pretty useless, but they're better than nothing. And they enabled me to teach people how to learn myself and to teach other people how to use them. And you can power fun things, such as you can get a lot of music out of a small amount of battery.
Yeah.
Well, actually,
yeah.
That's what we're going to move on to next. So we've talked about, as I said, battery and panel. And obviously, you can look up on the internet how to wire these together. It's actually reasonably simple if you're in any way practically minded. So well, how to actually utilise this power, I think, is a very interesting way, because this sort of system is referred to as a 12-volt system, and that's actually the same as cars.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. If you think of everything in line as a 12-volt, I mean, 12-volts is quite simple. People are used to putting, like, batteries in their ghetto blaster, for instance, and, like, they line up positive to negative, so, you know, you're in conjunction increasing the voltage of a 1.4 battery up to 12 volts, and, like, as soon as you get to 12 volts, you can sort of, like, run it off a car battery rather than buying batteries from a shop, you know?
Absolutely. So, for instance, a couple of, as Chan actually was just about to mention, one of the excellent uses of 12-volt is 12-volt sound systems. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about
that? Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, basically any car music amplification equipment will be good to go off your battery, so you can either get hold of a cheap car stereo, which would maybe have a radio CD player in it itself, or a power amplifier, which you actually put in a music signal from something like...
Using phono cables.
Yeah, sure. I mean, my system, for example, I've got power amplifier that enables me to plug in, say, an MP3 player, and I've just got a couple of speakers, two power amplifiers. I put in an MP3 player, and I just stick those on bread baskets, put the bread baskets on wheels, get some bungees over the top, make sure the battery's not going to fall over, and you've got a mobile system to take out on demos.
Wicked. That's what we're all about, is the mobile music,
my friend. It keeps morale up, yeah, it's great.
Excellent. And what other type of uses of a portable 12-volt system could you think of? I mean, I know they're not exactly optimal for boiling kettles.
No, you wouldn't want to put too much load across your inverter. That's for sure.
An inverter is?
It's a device to convert 12-volt DC, as in a car battery, to mains AC, which you would use in your house. But depending on the inverter, you can get like clean inverters or what I call dirty inverters. It's to do with modified sine wave or simulated sine wave or pure sine wave, which might be getting too technical for some people, but depending on what you want to run off it, if you want like a really clean music or computer system, then I'd go for pure sine wave. But like if you just want like some dirty power to run some basement or something, then you know a cheap inverter.
I think
unfortunately from Maplin's will do.
So I think it's in relation to really how much you're prepared to spend on a lot of these things will give you the quality you desire.
Yeah, yes. Sure. I mean, one thing I would say, I started off with 12 volt, and I still prefer 12 volt. The reason being that 240 volt can kill you. So
ooh, that's bad.
So you can run most things straight off 12 volt. You can actually run a laptop, a phone charger, all these things that have a cigarette socket. That means you can go straight off a battery. You can normally bypass using mains, and then you don't need to buy an inverter, and you don't need to worry about earth and electrical safety. You just need to worry about not accidentally shorting out your battery terminals.
So I think that's very important. 12 volt is a far more human-friendly system.
And it's more efficient.
Cool. So we've had a bit of a chat about what we use the power for. Would you give us any like power tips you want to give our happy campers? And obviously thinking about those who are listening on the internet. Take out your battery.
I guess a top tip is not to use your phone when you don't need it and to turn it off at night.
Yeah, unplug stuff that you're not using, you know, stuff that's on standby, like, you know, it's a total waste of power.
If you're using solar panels and the sun's out, then the best time to charge anything is when there's more sun, you know?
Totally.
The efficiency is better because there's an input rather than no input whatsoever.
So, for example, today, I mean, it's really overcast and it's not very windy at all. I mean, so how much power...
We're working at the moment on batteries, obviously. I mean, in a system, one of the most important things is how many batteries you have, so that if you're doing a festival or doing
capacity,
some kind of event,
storage power.
Yeah, that it can be done over 4 to 5 days. You know, if it pours or rain tomorrow and the next day, then you know we have made allowances for the fact that the weather might not be good over the next 2 days. Mm-hmm. So we've kept an extra secret little set of batteries somewhere that are fully charged.
Well, we didn't get our lorry on, which has got 1,000 amp hours on it, you know, so like...
In case you use it for criminal damage, play really bad music really loud or something. No answers to that one.
Thank you.
I'd like to make one final point, really, which is to say that pretty much all the electricity use on the whole site is equivalent to one of those spotlights that the police are using on their diesel generator.
Yeah, that's good. That is immense.
I was trying to calculate how much power the police had used, like, compared to what we've actually used on site, and I think they're like way over what we've used.
Absolutely. Each one of those spots is going to be at 1.5 kilowatt, and that's roughly what we're using total.
Would you not go down to them and give out to them for being over their power allowance?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, I haven't seen the council. Last year when the council came round, I pointed out that the only people who had a diesel generator and didn't have a bond underneath it were the police and the council. You know, you really don't want to be using diesel. It's obviously just wrong in so many ways.
Yeah.
Unless you make your own, of course.
Ooh, it's a biofuel argument.
Out of waste, veg oil, that's...
Veg oil is the way forward. All right, guys, well, listen, thank you very much for coming in, and thank you very much for keeping us going, and the rest of the camp going as well. Everyone out there who's texting away and listening has really enjoyed the power they're getting.
Just actually, if you just wanted to like give out some web resources that people can kind of follow up on this discussion with, if you haven't, that springs to mind.
Well, my website's www.raycentre-mundo.co.uk.
Cool. That explains why your nickname's Raymundo.
Nickname? What do you mean nickname?
I can be contacted through my business, which is t4sustainability.co.uk.
Cool.
And we're on a Coltech WW bloody blah.
Search for Coltech.
Just ding up Coltech. I think it's quite easily found. There was a schnooze. Yeah, that we could.
All right, so we can definitely find we can definitely find information about you guys and what's going on there.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And if there's anybody out there in the camp that's listening that needs information and 12 volt stuff, then
we're all willing to talk about.
That's what you're for.
Share our information,
and if you want to learn, come and help.
I'd actually recommend that myself. I suppose I must own up to being one of Chan's wee students. And it's an incredibly interesting practical skill to learn. It makes you feel a lot more at ease.
Conscious about what you're doing in your life, you know.
Definitely. All right, well, again, thanks very much, guys. It's been a pleasure to have you in. Very welcome here to the studio. And next we're going to go to the food review. Yeah, so what we've got here, we've got two people who have been around to a few of the barrios who were making curry tonight. So, what we're going to go for is we're going to do a curry off. So they've got these wonderful plates of food here. Some are small, some are big, so perhaps we might get to eat some afterwards. So, who have we got here doing our curry off? We have...
I'm Ben, and... I've been doing stuff in the Be The Media space.
Cool. And who's with you?
I'm Nicole. I'm actually came a long way from Canada, and I'm here representing EnviroSpeak TV.
Well, thanks for coming in, guys. Very, very welcome to the studio. So, we've got a couple of curries. And so, who are we going to start off with?
Okay, well, let's hope we can remember what all these portions are. When we got asked to do this, I thought it was a really good blank because we could avoid having to queue.
Okay.
And we'd get to taste everything. But actually, most of them weren't ready. So we've got hard rice. We think we've got hard rice. We haven't tried it yet. And we've been waiting now, and it's all cold. So we're going to be trying not quite cooked and slightly cold curry. So the first one is the big blue plate. This is from West Midlands.
That one?
Okay.
Okay, so what do we think about the looks of the food first off?
Well, I must say, I this is supposed to be a curry off, and this doesn't look like a curry to me.
This one looks more like a stew, I think. It's
definitely a heavy root vegetable stew. Mm-hmm. This is supposed to come with mashed potato, but unfortunately we missed the mashed potato. So those mashed potato fans, West Midlands is the place to be tonight, definitely. So I think we actually might have missed the seasoning as well on this one, so it might be a little bit of an unfair test. Let's have a taste.
All right, here we go.
Tucking in now.
Lovely. Oh, yeah. Chewing. Plenty of chews.
Yeah.
Oh, there's some curry there. Mm, oh, actually, it's quite hot.
Can we have some water to the front of this?
And where's my Kingfisher beer? Oh, product placement.
Yeah.
It's got celery in. It's not a good sign.
They're going for seconds, though. I don't know if they're just being thorough or if they actually
crunchy.
Like it.
Crunchy. Quite hot.
Okay.
That's not bad. I can imagine it with mashed potato would be a nice
one. Mashed potato would have bumped up.
Do you want to do a marks out of 10?
I think we should probably do
wait
the rest.
The end,
yeah. Otherwise, it'll be like come dine with me. It'll just be cheating.
Yeah.
Okay. I've never watched that. I'll take your word for it.
Okay, so what we've got next? The four little green plate. That's that one.
Yeah.
Okay. Now
the presentation on this one is excellent.
This one does look wonderful. So
it is a rather small portion, though.
Yeah. Well, I guess the blag wasn't that good then. So this is kind of what we got there. We've got cauliflower and aubergine, carrots.
You've also got salad, which is nice.
Got some salad, and we've got an amazing looking rice dish with all kinds of seeds and
it's apparently,
tomatoes in it.
Yeah, they said that the rice had, it was like a coconut rice with tomatoes and...
I'm sorry, where is this from?
This one is Eastside, and they seemed very confident that they were going to be the...
Well, I won't say which one, but they did say that one of the other curries looked like McDonald's. So
I didn't know McDonald's did curry.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, the rice is definitely needs another 10 minutes.
Al dente.
But the actual curry looks amazing. Let's have a go.
You don't look the little mint leaf on the side there.
Good mix of vegetables there. Nice bit of colour on the plate as well. I like it. Visually appealing food.
Absolutely.
On the radio.
Yeah.
Chunky cut. Very...
It's like Indian spice almost. Yeah. It's quite nice. Yeah.
It's like proper Indian curry. Proper curry.
Okay.
Okay, I think we should go to the next one.
Yeah, definitely.
I rate that quite highly.
The salad we can't actually taste because it's a curry off, not a salad off. So.
Yeah.
That's tomorrow now.
Yeah.
Okay, so next one. It's the purple-green looking thing. Okay.
This one it makes me a little bit nervous because, first of all, it's purple. But and
I don't know about anyone else. I mean, look at this. What does that look to you?
I don't think we can say on the radio, to be quite honest
with
you.
Just eat it.
Okay, so this is Oxford.
This is Oxford.
It could be surprising, though.
It could be. Let's be surprised. Okay.
Oxford were supremely confident when we ran into them earlier. Okay.
I don't want to take too much.
I don't want to sound like a cop describing someone's face when they say no comment. However,
that looked nearly like a wretch.
The suspect has grimaced.
Right. Yeah. Okay. They're not happy at all with that.
Okay. Do you want to just give us criticism on that?
It has a very strong eggplant taste. And seeds, lots of seeds and raisins.
Okay, and was this ready? Is this the finished product, yeah?
No.
Okay.
It was also not ready, was it?
It was also not ready, yeah.
It's very interesting. And, I mean, it really is. It has, you know, there's people who say you really shouldn't put fruit in curry. Well, this one definitely has fruit and bird seeds.
Okay. That does sound interesting.
And it's purple. But I reckon somebody would like it.
Birds, maybe.
When it's finished.
Yeah.
It might just, you know, the flavours might have needed to meld a little bit more.
Mm. And the colour change.
And the colour change to a more curry-like colour.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
So we won't get served in Oxford again, so let's move on to the next one.
So this is this dual
anonymous?
Plating.
Okay. So we're on to the big portion on the big plate. This is Yorkshire. And
Yorkshire gave you quite a generous helping up there.
Yeah.
There's no retching going on anyway.
It's very cold.
It's very cold.
Okay. They were actually serving, weren't they? So this is finished.
Yeah, the vegetables were actually cooked, so...
It's definitely cooked, and it was definitely finished. Mm-hmm. Very, very mild.
A nice blend of flavours, though. I mean, it...
Yeah, you it's can tell tasty, that but very mild. I like my curries a bit more...
Punchy.
A bit more kick.
Okay.
You can even see the herbs in it.
Right. So at this point, do you think you're prepared to give a marks out of 10?
No, we've got the one left, and then I think we'll go back through the marks. We've got the one left, and this is the Anarchist Teapot.
All right.
Oh, so you've actually done two curries on one plate?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But you think we could carry five plates?
Well, there's two of you.
This is the salmon-coloured curry with, again, I think, a coconut rice. Oh yeah.
That's definitely.
Oh yeah.
Definitely nice.
Seconds.
Oh, seconds.
It's also the most thick. It's the thickest curry I think out of them in terms of the sauce. So out of all of them.
Oh, I like
it's
that.
It's the brightest too.
And it was our smallest portion, which is a shame because we're definitely gonna have to go back.
Okay, so we're gonna use two. We're actually going for seconds and thirds on this plate. So before we let you finish your dinners. Do you want to start giving us a bit of ratings?
Okay.
Should we score them from like best to worst? Or best to not so best?
The best to last, I'd say. Keeps the tension going.
Okay, so the one to avoid?
I would have to go with, unfortunately, Oxford.
Yeah, we go for Oxford. One to avoid.
Right.
Ooh.
Not going to make any friends there.
Oh. No.
I don't know. I wasn't all that on the chunky.
The Midlands one is probably the next one.
West Midlands. If you're a mashed potato person, then regardless, then that's obviously the one to go for. So
I would have to say probably Yorkshire would be the next one for me. So like third one. Place. Yeah,
I agree.
Definitely.
Yorkshire in third place. So second place.
We've got a playoff between the Anarchist Teapot and
Eastside.
Eastside
and Anarchist Ooh. Teapot. Mm. Oh dear.
This could be the formation of a split in the camp.
I'm actually going to say I really like the Indian flavors of the East Side one, although the rice wasn't cooked. The rice wasn't really part of it, so I would probably say
I think we'll have to go for joint winners then, because I'm going to go for Anarchist Teapot.
No.
We've got to work with these people.
All right, so we're going for sort of a consensus decision on a joint winner.
When I go back for seconds, it's definitely going to be
Well, they're probably listening to you at the moment, so they'll spot you.
And put one aside. I might go off and get the mashed potato to go with it.
Right. Well, now I think we're going to go into a bit of Seize the Day.
Recorded last night,
so yeah.
Song is called Silence, I believe.
Okay. I hope, yeah. Here it is now. ZH954 came alive to the sound of singing. Hammers, the hanging banners, the scattering of seeds and ashes on its wings, and the women waited to see what justice for 2.4 million damaged done. 13 million for anyone. We are not martyrs or heroines. We owe so much to our friends who held our courage in their hands. My hammer, I break the chain. I will not remain.
Now you're doing really well. Now, we're leaving tonight because we've got a gig somewhere else tomorrow. But we're sure as hell going to try and come back on Saturday. Because I can't think of anything more important in the whole world. Apart from, of course, PlayStation, yes, that's great heckle there at the back. After half a year in jail, they came before a court, and the truth the jury heard and saw stung them into silence. Then, when the verdict came, begin to settle on the ground, a gentle
Climate Camp, and it is August the 8th, and I have a couple of announcements to make for you guys. If you're out somewhere and you want to do an interview, there are two numbers you can call, those being 0207-0433-783, and that's menu number 2, or you can also call 0163-4210-111. Both of those can be used when you're out doing anything at any point tomorrow. I'm not going to ask you what, but just call in and we'll be able to receive it and put it on the radio tomorrow. So please do that for us. There's a film in Scotland and Newcastle called Dodgy Development. DFID in India is showing it at 8 p.m., so please go check that out. And please go to the welcome tent and sign up for the rolling blockade that is going to be organized to stop E.ON building Kings North, because Climate Camp is not the end. So go over and give your details and pick up your return ticket. And we have two people here to tell us about some of the actions that happened today, Amy and Sam. So could you give us a quick update as to what's going on?
Well, this morning, 12 people superglued themselves naked to the Department for Business Enterprise and Regulatory Reform, to the front of the office there. They did it to highlight the naked truth about the UK government's investment in coal and declare that the proposal to build Kings North is not as clean as E.ON would like the public to believe. The placards covering their privates said, "Clean coal is science fiction. If E.ON sticks to dirty power, we will stick to E.ON, and a zero carbon future is possible."
Nice. That must have been entertaining. And what else happened today?
Some people from Rising Tide, Norwich, London and Leamington Spa super glued again themselves to the front door of the oil and gas division of Royal Bank of Scotland. With a banner saying RBS cashing in on coal. RBS finance projects responsible for more emissions than Scotland. And this was on the day that they announced their six-month figures, and they've made millions of losses, which is the first time they've actually lost money. And that followed hot on the heels of yesterday when People and Planet actually hit their headquarters.
And is there another action that happened today?
Yeah, there's a final one in Legoland today.
Yay.
On the power station that's sponsored by E.ON there, a few Lego people, Lego activists, did a banner drop. The banner said, "Stop climate change." And we have been told that the police and the activists couldn't comment because they're all made of Lego.
Nice one. Always a bit of fun out in activist land. So next we're going to go into an interview that we did with David from CAT, the Center for Alternative Technology. Chickpea.
I'm Patrick.
From Climate Camp Radio, and we are sitting here with David from CAT, which is the Center for Alternative Technology. What is CAT and what does it do? Maybe give us a bit of background.
CAT is a sustainability organisation. It was set up 35 years ago to find practical solutions to the issues of sustainable living. So CAT looks at energy, at building materials, at recycling, at composting, and all these types of things. And 30-odd years of trying to play with these technologies, of practicing with them, and teaching others from basically the things that we've got right and the things we've got wrong.
So maybe you can describe some of the systems that you have in place and have experimented with.
We've had lots of different things. We provide all our own electricity and our own heat. We have our own water treatment and sanitation systems. As the centre's got bigger and bigger, as we've done more and more training and more education and we write books and things like that, we've had to expand all those systems. So we now have electricity from wind, from water, from photovoltaics, and we're just building a combined heat and power plant that runs on wood, and that will also provide all the heat for site. And that's quite innovative. There are very few of them in this country, so we're experimenting with it. And then we're going to try and use that for greenhouses and for sequestration of carbon, perhaps. So basically, sort of trying to see how practically you can use these things, trying to put them in place and live with them to see what it really does and how it really works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and on the practicality scale, how easy or difficult is it for the average individual to incorporate some of the things that you have at CAT?
It depends on what it is you're trying to do. The first of all of these things is to try and use less energy in the first place, or use less water, less materials, because it makes everything a lot easier, a lot cheaper, a lot simpler. Then from that, it depends on what it is that you use most of, what you spend your money on, what's the most polluting activities you do. Everybody has a different reason for trying to do this. They want to save more money, or they want to produce less carbon, or everybody has a different reason. So you would try and choose a technology that reduces your biggest expenditure. And it depends on where you live. Some things are more practical if you live in the countryside in a big house with loads of land, there are lots of things that are very easy. If you live in a block of flats, it's a lot harder. Mm-hmm. So there's no one solution. We use most of our energy in terms of heat. So things that keep your house warm and systems for replacing the heating system with something more sustainable, that's always a good bet. Solar thermal systems, things like that. Mm-hmm. Then we move on to the electricity generation, because that's usually a little more expensive.
Do you think it's possible to kind of live sustainably in an urban setting where you don't have as much land, where you can do things and it's not possible to generate all your own electricity?
It's possible, but you have to be part of a bigger network. There's a lot of talk of wanting to be very separate, very, very off-grid, to separate yourself off from the rest of society. And it doesn't work like that. If we're going to do these things, we have to do them all together. You can buy your electricity from a 100% green supplier if you live in a flat, and that's then all come from renewables if you buy it from a good supplier. So you can do that without having to have the expense of putting up photovoltaics or wind turbines, because that's not really practical in your situation. So you can still live a very, very green, very sustainable lifestyle even if you live in a city, but we have to have the countrywide infrastructure to make that possible.
I'm personally concerned with the raw materials that are necessary to create some sustainable energy producing mechanisms. Maybe you have some sort of insight on that, and whether it's actually possible to move away from these materials that will become more rare in the future.
All of the things that we build have to require some energy, some materials. So we tend to look at the life cycle cost of this, how much energy it produces compared to how much it takes to build, and how long it takes to pay those things off. So, and it's a good decision as whether that technology is right for where you live. A wind turbine in a windy place will pay off its energy costs, embodied energy, very, very quickly. If you bolt it onto your house in the middle of a housing estate, it may never pay for itself. That's a very good indicator of whether it's worthwhile, and you have to pick the right technology for the right location because of that, as well as the monetary cost. I suppose people do try and look at making these things more sustainable because of all the industries. People who are making systems for renewable technologies are quite aware of the sustainability, the sustainable nature of their products. Mm-hmm. It would be a lie to say that there isn't any impact with them at all, and I suppose it's something we just have to keep our eye on to demand the same level as we do from everything else we buy.
So do you think that renewable energy will ever be able to become mass consumable, something that will be able to be afforded by kind of everybody rather than just kind of people who are willing to pay a premium?
Yes, but it's going to take a lot of doing. It's something that has to come down from a government level. It has to be something that we lobby for, that we push for, to force the energy companies to supply more of our energy from sustainable resources, because there are people who can't afford to buy these systems for their individual houses. And some people, as we've said, don't live in places where it's suitable. Some people just can't afford it. So we as a country have to provide those things on a national basis so that it's renewable energy available for all. If you plug something into the wall, that you know it's coming from renewable sources. But we can only do that by getting our politicians, by lobbying them, by forcing them, by whatever means, to accept higher levels of renewables penetration into the grid. And it's perfectly feasible. We can design renewable energy grids for the country which will run on 20%, 50% or 100% renewables. It's you just have to have that target and work towards it. The problem is if you change from one to the other, then it becomes a big issue. You have to know what it is you're aiming for, and we have to stick to those targets.
So do you think that renewable energy has the potential to fill the kind of real or perceived energy gap that seems to be looming?
Definitely. Britain has one of the highest renewable energy resources in Europe. We have the most amount of wind, of tidal energy. We're basically the Saudi Arabia of renewable resource. The energy gap, as it's perceived, is because of the nature of our consumption of energy. The national grid was set up so that you could have as much power as you wanted whenever you wanted it. That was the aim behind it. So we have a lot of redundancy built in. We have safeguards upon safeguards. We have a system which is designed to be consumed to excess. What we need is a different system, a system where energy is agreed it's not limited, it's not limitless, sorry, that you pay an increased price for having that energy whenever you want it. It doesn't mean that people can't have energy, but if I want to do something right here, right now, I pay more for that. If I'm willing to wait a little bit until it's a little bit windier and the waves are a little stronger, then my energy is cheaper. And that's very easy to do. There are lots of devices out there which a lot of things we do are not time critical in terms of the energy it uses. Your fridge, for example, doesn't have to be isn't on all the time. It comes on for 5 minutes an hour. If it chooses to do that now, then electricity could be a certain price. If it waits 10 minutes, electricity might be a little cheaper. And to put these devices on fridges costs about £5 a fridge. Mm-hmm. It's not a massive investment, but it's something that needs to be done, again, as a national strategy to make these things possible. It has to be kind of done all at once.
And do you think that renewables have the potential to supply like really heavily energy intensive industries like, you know, smelting or something like that, where you just use abundant amount of energy?
Again, it's possible. All of these processes, as energy becomes more expensive, it's amazing how much they look at how much energy it consumes and ways that that can be reduced. One of the key components in the cost of materials at the moment is the energy that goes into processing it. And it's a simple financial necessity that those processes are now revisited, far outside of the ideas of climate change and energy security. It's just simple business practice to redesign these systems to be less energy intensive. But the energy that's required for them still has to come from somewhere, and that could just as easily be renewables as it could be fossil fuels or nuclear.
I kind of take issue with the idea that we have to appeal so much to governmental structures in order for the infrastructure to change. I mean,
I agree, and I believe that we should all take responsibility for what we do and where that energy comes from. The fact that these systems are centralized mm-hmm. means that you have to approach the central point where that power congregates. You have to work with, to a certain extent, work with what's there. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean we can't change it in many ways. There are a lot of different and better ways of doing what we do. Mm-hmm. But all these things can't happen overnight. And there is a limit to the practicality of me doing absolutely everything myself, there has to be a certain amount of sharing, a certain amount of working with others to make this possible. You're right, it doesn't have to be at a government level, it can just as easily be at a community level. But the idea that we all just wrap ourselves up in little boxes and do it for ourselves isn't going to work.
Oh yeah, I completely understand that it just does not make sense for the individual to try and be entirely self-sufficient. It's impossible, and it's also counterproductive, I think, on a social level. My issue is with the sort of the green authoritarianism that can sort of happen with regulating energy, and I think the issue is taking away the power of the people that provide the power, in a sense. And
The nice thing about renewable energy is that by its very nature it is decentralized. It's no longer held in a dozen large power stations. It's spread all over the countryside. It becomes part of us. It becomes something that we live with, in and around. So by that very nature you feel more connected to it. You have more of a say in how it happens, about where it goes, for good and for bad. But we get a lot more contact with it. It's good to be aware of where these things come from, because you have more awareness, more appreciation of it. Ideally, everybody should be very, very keen on knowing everything about where it all comes from, but in the society we live in, people aren't. I mean, being here, you're sort of preaching to the converted in that respect. Yeah. But we have to, I suppose, work on behalf of those people who aren't that committed, that interested, that bothered by it, and make those decisions for them.
Just in terms of the decentralised nature of renewable power, I mean, we have a lot of Medway residents here who are kind of unhappy about the kind of asthma levels and the social and environmental impacts that Kings North and the other kind of polluting, the other kind of sources of pollution around here have, but there's kind of similar problems with decentralized renewable power. I mean, you have, especially with wind power, there's a lot of kind of local opposition to large wind farms being erected. Like, we had the island in the Outer Hebrides that was a kind of potentially huge source of wind power. That project has now been turned down on the basis of local opposition.
The difference between something like a coal-fired power station and a wind farm is that the basis for opposition of a wind farm is almost entirely aesthetic. It's the visual impact on our environment. There are other concerns, but if you get down to it, basically, people don't like the way they look. And because you have to have a lot more of them, they physically take up more space and they're more visual, that's what people pick on. People don't like how coal-fired power stations look either. They're not the prettiest of items. But there's only one of them. Well, there's only one of them within 50 miles or so. So it's not such an issue. But you don't have the same health concerns. So what people have found is that in areas where they've had wind farms put up, for example, wind farms is a good example for this country, that there tends to be a big drop in people's enthusiasm for the system just as it's being built. And then when the system's actually in place and people start living with it, they find that it's not as bad as they thought. All these impacts, the visual, the noise, the flicker, these things that people talk about aren't actually really big concerns at all. You just get used to it being there and you don't have the asthma, the sulfur dioxide, the acid rain, all the other environmental concerns. All you have is a spinning wind turbine.
How come they all have to be white? Could you not like paint them green or like make them blend in a bit?
That's a good question. In theory, you could paint them any colour you like. I believe they paint them white because they're supposed to blend in more easily. But one of the nice things that we do have is a policy of not allowing people to write things all over wind turbines, so you can't use them as big spinning advertising boards. So be thankful they all have to be white, otherwise you'll be seeing Tesco's labels all over them.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably a case of watch this space.
I guess I just have one more question about the imperceived effects of the technology of renewables. Invariably, there's going to be something that we don't know about that is going to be problematic, and we're going to have to fix that, and it's a case of always relying on technology.
a lot of the perceptions of problems with renewables come from misinformation, sort of lack of understanding. A lot of the technologies are they're becoming more and more established. We're getting to know a lot more about the effects that they have on the environment. Wind turbines, for example, we know a lot of the problems that they had when they first built wind turbines. Mm-hmm. Things like bird strikes and things like that. And that was quite easy to fix. We don't put wind turbines where birds migrate and things like that. It took a bit of practice, but we learn very quickly from those mistakes. And with every new technology, there are going to be things that we find, things that we have to address and deal with. But I suppose we try and learn from the mistakes that we've made and as much as is possible predict what's going to be an effect and how you get around it. But a lot of these technologies are passive technologies. They're very benign. They should, in theory, have very little impacts. So I would hope, as much as possible, we're making them as clean and as green as possible. The whole point of them is that you can install these systems and pretty much just leave them there for us and generations to come. So I'd want to build something that was gonna still be working in a nice, healthy, sustainable fashion for well into the future.
The cases of things like the Severn Barrier, where there is like an impact on nature and on things like wind turbines and bird strikes on migratory patterns, I mean, do you think there has to be a trade-off made for kind of the future of the planet versus the kind of localized ecosystem that may be very important? But
Severn Barrage is a fantastic example of exactly that type of situation. The theoretical potential of a scheme like that could provide huge amounts of our national energy, and that's why it's one that's talked about. But there are massive environmental impacts associated with that. Mm-hmm. So it is always going to be a balance. Everything we do has a footprint, a result from doing that, and you have to weigh up in the long term whether that impact is small enough, whether it's worth making that construction and dealing with the consequences afterwards. There are a lot of other proposals for the River Severn, such as tidal lagoons, or which are smaller systems. You end up with a lot more of them, and they have less of an impact because they don't fully obstruct the river. I think if it's going to go ahead, at the end of the day, it'll be something more like that type of technology, because you still get a lot of the energy out of it, but you don't get the same, quite as much of the environmental impact. Mm-hmm. But we do have to weigh up the bigger picture. I would love that we could do things which had absolutely no impact at all, but it's trying to make a system which still produces the most amount of energy, but has the least impact at all. I suppose it's there's no easy way around it.
Well, on that note, we'll sign off. Thank you very much for coming in to speak with us, and good luck with CAT.
Thank you very much.
brother is telling me now. His deep feelings about that thing. And how these children deserve a good future, a good education, and somewhere to live. They deserve the moon, the sky and the mountains, food, medication, and the right to dream. Having protection, full accommodation, like all the children they deserve to be. It's government, they don't give a damn, no, no. They don't give a damn. Many little kids living on the streets that are poor. Many rich people, rich governments, they don't give a damn, no, 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 no.
If you like that music, check them out on their MySpace page. Anyway, just a quick announcement before we carry on, and that's just to say, for anybody who's staying on site tomorrow, which is the mass day of action, the designated safe space is Yorkshire. It's the Yorkshire space, which is basically on top of the hill near the main marquee. So basically, after 7 a.m, cops raid, go there. Okay, if you're staying on site, make yourself known. Make yourself useful, okay? All right, so we're going to move on with the show now. And last night, I believe it was, we had an interview with some people who had written an open letter to the neighbourhoods. And in this letter, one of the key points, I think, was questioning the direction in which the camp is taking and questions whether or not the camp risks losing touch with its anti-capitalist, anti-authoritarian roots and appear as a gathering that lends its support to top-down, state-centred responses to the crisis climate change and energy depletion posed for capitalism. Now, in response to that, we've had someone come up to us who just wants to have a little bit of a chat about this letter. Hello, Chris.
Hi there.
Hi. So, just do you want to tell us a little bit about what your thoughts on the letter are and the content?
Well, I thought to start with, to call yourself anti-authoritarian and you're intent on closing down debate is just completely out of order. I mean, it's what Hitler and Stalin did, you know? You can't talk about this, not allowed.
Well, this is the point. I think one of the points of this letter is to open up debate, which is why we're here today, which is the first thing, I think, to say. And I think that anything... So perhaps this is being used perhaps to promote debate.
I didn't see it like that, and I don't think people in our neighbourhood did when we discussed it. There was overwhelming resistance to it. One or two people thought it was some good points, but basically people said it was, you know, didn't like it, especially the bit about confrontational attitude. You know, love your neighbour, for only then can you turn him into a friend. That was Martin Luther King. And, you know, We're small enough as it is, the opponents of climate change, so to kind of split the movement down, say only anarchists are allowed here, we're not having anything to do with Greens and with socialists, is really bad for the movement. We've got to stick together. We've got our differences, so instead of saying, well, we're not going to talk about these, we got to debate them and say, well, you know, what is it that's wrong with your view of things, and how do you see this, and why do we see it differently, and come to some kind of solution. That's what we're here for, to discuss things. That's what we do in the workshops, which is why Climate Camp is so great. It's not just the direct action, it's the workshops, which are really magic. We've got some brilliant workshops about all sorts of stuff, and I think it'd be a real shame if we were cut out all of the debate about exactly how we're going to solve the climate crisis in a sort of international and national policy level.
You want to respond?
I was here the other day in the interview, and I think it's unfortunate that you misinterpreted our intentions so vastly in other barriers. I think that there was not a feeling that this letter was intended to close off debate or to exclude a point of view. But there were, I think, the main intention of the letter was simply to provoke debate. We didn't really have an expectation that, you know, we were trying to really establish these particular principles for the camp at this moment. Rather, we wanted to have a very explicit political discussion in the camp about the politics of the camp, about whether the core message and the core of the politics that is happening here, in line with the horizontal, decentralized, do-it-yourself way in which the camp itself is organized, is that solutions to the converging environmental crises and other social crises of the 21st century are solutions that should come from the bottom up, solutions that can be based on direct, constructive action of people in their communities, solutions that are human scale, and solutions that promote more equality and more freedom in society. And we believe that this has to be a very, very central thing to the camp. Now, for example, there was one of the discussions about carbon trading and emissions trading. We had a guest in the camp. I'm very glad he came. He was from a carbon emissions trading company that facilitates that kind of lucrative new market that privatizes the atmosphere. Now, he did not engage with any of the critiques of privatizing the atmosphere that would pour forward in that workshop. All he tried to do was swing this entirely to his agenda and convince everybody how great it is and how profitable it was to create a market in tradable emission permits. And the question is whether, when we have that kind of encounter, and I think it's a very positive and healthy encounter to have, okay, whether it is that the central space, what this camp is about, is up for grabs for anyone from the corporation who wants to make money off it, to those who want it to be a community solution, to those who want a very strong police state to enforce austerity on the population, whether that is really open, or whether you have a core in this of the political content of this camp that is about direct action in the constructive sense too, to put forward alternative forms of living, alternative forms of social production, of food production, of energy production, of conviviality between human beings, to create a new society, which is as the necessity of confronting climate change and other environmental crises, and that other points of view can come in and debate that, can come in and engage with that and learn from that. But I think that it is important for there to be some form of political basic unity about what the camp is about. I think there should be some statement of unity coming out of this camp and defining it as a political space. Otherwise, I'm really, I was really worried, and as were many others who participated in this, that we would, in a way, bring into the world this new form of militant lobbying, you know, to direct action and confrontation, civil disobedience, as a form of pressure on governments. And this, I think, would be a real bastardization, if you will, of direct action and its tradition. One final point. I think that we need to be very careful about how this movement develops in these emergent stages. And I think that if there isn't something very clear there from the beginning, at least in one space, then it risks being completely off compass.
I would respond to that by saying that you shouldn't try and narrow it down to merely the anarchist tradition. Anarchists are very few and far between. Mostly younger, tending not to vote, so not having much power in the sense of traditional political power. And I think no matter what happens, I don't think you're going to overthrow the world power before you stop climate change. It's going to take a long, long while. You've got to work with the powers that be already, which are the people that kind of are elected into governments, which is socialists and greens. And you've got to put the pressure on them. There's a place for anarchy in direct action, in showing the way and illustrating what can be done, which is exactly what Climate Camp does, what it's very good at. But to just throw away all forms of sort of state authority, I think is very naive. I mean, I think, you know, you talk about freedom. All right, let's be a bit brutal in the argument here, but you don't allow paedophiles the freedom to murder children, do you? So why allow tourists the freedom to fly on holiday, which is going to lead to the death of millions, if not billions, of children in the future? You have to have some sort of state control, and I think you have to have some sort of rationing of flying and another sort of venue. Right. Exactly how that rationing happens.
I think it's a really cheap comparison that you're making here between paedophilia or child murder and flying. But I'd like to say this. In no sense do I think that the climate camp should exclude greens, socialists, liberals, NGOs, any of those things. Yeah, but the question is, what kind of responses are those actors going to take when they inevitably do their lobbying or electoral parliamentary work? Are they going to uncritically support very strong governmental means or free market-based means in an uncritical way just to get the government to do something, thereby playing along with the desire of the ruling class to turn this crisis into an opportunity for tighter social control, or whether the Green Movement will continue to hold on to its own roots of radical democracy, of community control, whether these things are going to remain central. Because my concern is, you know, I mean, I, of course I'd rather see Greens in Parliament and Socialists in Parliament than Tories in Labour, okay? But my concern is that at that stage, they're going to become the new oppressors. So I want to make sure that at this camp there is a very strong presence of a critique that says everything has to start from the grassroots, and the power has to stay with the grassroots, and that any move to deal with climate change as well as other crises has to involve more, not less, democracy.
Yeah, well, I would agree with you. We do need more democracy. The democracy that we've got now is completely flawed because the politicians are in the pockets, most of them at least, not the Greens and not lots of socialists. They're in the pockets of big business.
I'm talking about democracy beyond parliament and electoral politics. I'm talking about communities actually having participatory venues for local decision-making, political decentralization, all these things that were at the center of the Green agenda and still remain in the UK Green Party, I believe.
Yeah, we are still very much a decentralist party, but I think we also have to recognise that global warming is a global problem, so it deserves and demands a global solution. You cannot each individual community sort of decide how you're going to solve it. Like, if you're in each an individual household, there's no point in changing your light bulb, cycling to work, when your neighbour flies off to Bali every month. You've got to have some form of social control to stop the problem of free riders. People are kind of, you know, using up lots and lots of carbon, producing lots and lots of emissions. If there's a few of those, it doesn't matter what the majority of us do. The climate is still going to be pushed beyond its tipping point because it's at a critical level now.
But my whole point is that you don't need to have... Social control is not the only way to get over the individualist or the egoist behavior of people who have been atomized. Community and social solidarity is another way of doing that, is another way of generating collective action. The question is whether we are still on the ball in terms of really transforming society as the response to this climate crisis, or whether this has gone off the agenda and this crisis is so hard that we are prepared to accept the tools of the dominating society we live in to deal with it and divest ourselves of all our values. That was basically my concern.
I think that in the long run, you're right, we need to change society. But to change society will take a generation at least. We haven't got that time. We really haven't got any time. We should have started acting yesterday, which is why we're going to need to bring carbon emissions down very, very, very rapidly indeed. And without very firm control, it's just not going to happen. It's got to be zero carbon as quickly as possible.
Could I just do a quick response? I think Yuri's done a wonderful job so far, but I think we need to... There's this, I think, what is fundamentally a myth that the state is in any way capable of dealing with the scope of this crisis. So if you look at any sort of state-centered solutions so far, they have been complete and utter miserable failures. They've only created further markets from climate change. They've made it worse than the worst possible scientific predictions. And what do we believe? I think the thesis is that somehow, if there's enough popular sort of begging of the state, you know, through some sort of mass electoral movement, you'll have a maybe Green Party or maybe the Swappies in power, and they'll begin sort of putting these measures of austerity for the common good into effect. I think that's incredibly unlikely. I think, you know, while anarchists are few and far between, Greens and socialists are incredibly few and far between and are in electoral politics ludicrously weak. What you're seeing, almost without fail, as in most of the world, is the return of nationalist parties, of parties which are fundamentally, particularly in places which are under some form of threat, proto-fascist at their core. I think we have to be very careful, because I think that what's more likely to happen with any sort of resort to a state-based solution is that people will use the excuse that, oh, we have to do this, this is such a big crisis, to sort of A, not do anything substantial to solve the crisis, and then B, use the excuse of the crisis to basically clamp down on popular dissent through these measures that are justified via green austerity. So what you're more likely to see is not a sort of benevolent, swappy dictatorship for the love of the planet, a Green Party control with maybe a slow generational change to democratic politics. What you think you're more likely to see in the next 5 years is some sort of green Stalinist state, which will fundamentally use climate change as a measure to control the people. And the climate change crisis will likely get worse. I don't think electoral politics can solve it. Well, the only thing which can obviously solve it is a change in a form of life. And that is what the anarchists and direct Democrats and the people at this camp are demonstrating. And that is not what the Greens or socialists are demonstrating.
Okay. Do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I think you're wrong there, because I think for your solution to work, we'll just take far, far too long. We haven't got any time at all. We don't want to clamp down on people other than say you can't use more than a fair amount of energy. So we have a sort of ration on the amount of energy that's going to be emitted. That's the only, and it's got to come down. That ration's got to come down very, very quickly indeed. 10% a year or so. That's the only way we're going to solve the problem of climate change. None of your solutions, laudable, noble though they seem, are going to have the practical effect in bringing energy down that we really need.
Quick response. You are mistaken, my friend. If you look at archaeological records, the transition from many societies from a fundamentally nomadic hunter-gatherer society to a farm-based society, which is a pretty large transition historically, has happened under the case of about a generation or possibly less, a generation or two. So large social changes do happen in periods of crisis, okay? I think what ultimately any state-based solution will do is attempt to maintain the current situation of complete crisis. And that I fundamentally trust that people in the period of crisis, unless there is a powerful state with the ability to clamp down on popular movements, will solve the crisis. And electoral politics do not fundamentally trust the people in their ability to change.
I don't think we need to clamp down on popular movements. I think we need to clamp down on the rich, people who will sort of fly off every month using up vast quantities of the Earth's atmospheric space. So that's the sort of authoritarianism I like. You know, stop the rich flying abroad every month. Don't clamp down on people like us.
And the rich control the state, and the Green Party and Swappies never will. This is what I think is a fundamental mistake, to believe that electoral politics will somehow make a non-capitalist state that will not transform into some sort of form of proto-fascism.
Okay, guys, we're actually just going to finish up now, because we've got to move on with the show, and it's been really, really good. But I'm just wondering if Chris, you'd like to just give us some closing remarks before we...
Yeah, I think both of our solutions look pretty remote, but I think ours of trying to sort of work through the electoral system is more likely to work than the anarchist system of completely overthrowing all the powers that be.
Cool. Thank you very much. And guys, any final words for us?
Well, comments? I think that we will no doubt be debating this in the next climate camp as well, but I would be appreciative if the climate camp process did come up with some much broader, of course, principles of unity. Maybe the confrontational bit was something that was lost a bit on many of the audience, but I think there should be principles of unity that enable us to have some political clarity on what this camp is about.
All right, can I just say thanks very much, guys.
Okay, that was a very, very interesting debate, and I hope it's a dialogue that will continue within the camp. We're going to be continuing on a slightly lighter note. We're coming up with the poo diary from the camp, followed by some information about rocket stoves, and then after that, today's media report from Vita.
Okay, so I've just been to use the straw bale urinal at the climate camp. I've done my urine, and I'm now going to go and use the loo with a view. So why, you might ask, would I use two toilets for two different kinds of relief? Well, the reason for that is because the urine goes onto straw bales, which are then composted. You don't want to mix your poos with your wees, because poo needs to be composted separately. That's right, I'm about to use a compost toilet for my shitting. It's a three-tier system. It's very interesting looking. And there are three of these eco-shitters in front of me. Two of them has doors, and one of them has a tarpaulin, which is flapping. And I need to go, so I think I'll use the free one, which is the eco-shitter with a flapping tarpaulin. I'm just going to climb into the eco-shitter and pop the recorder down. It's construction made entirely of wood, reclaimed, no doubt. Let's take off my jacket. Draw the tarpaulin round. Take a seat. So I'm now sitting about a metre and half off the ground on a toilet seat, which is suspended over a wheelie bin. There's a copy of the Earth First Action update for that toilet time reading. Toilet is well furnished with toilet paper. Okay, so having now made my deposit and cleaned myself up, I'm going to reach into the blue bucket next to the toilet seat and throw in a handful and a half of sawdust and wood chippings, which will provide the appropriate carbon to add to the nitrogen and other animal free waste products, which will go on to make a rather nifty nutrient rich compost, which once left for about a year and a half will be most fit to apply to my apple and plum trees. Maybe a bit longer, who knows, you might be daring enough to feed your root veg. Finally, I'll be off to wash my hands. Hi there, we're from Climate Camp Radio. What are you up to here?
I'm here with the rocket stoves, and we need rocket stoves here to boil cold water for purposes such as washing up liquid and to make tea and coffee. And then What it is basically two oil drums, or like vegetable oil drums, put together with cut slits so it fits in. And then it has a little tube, so it's like a chimney sort of thing. And you put the wood into the this little hole here. And that,
the hole at the bottom?
Yeah, the hole at the bottom. And then the heat produced in that hole in the bottom goes up to boil the water, and the saucepan is on top, so the heat doesn't just boil the bottom, but it boils all around.
I see. So are the saucepans in there, in these ones that we're looking at right now?
Yeah.
Okay, so they fit snugly into the oil drum.
And they've got a little slip for the spout.
So have you actually been building these yourself?
No, I'm just putting wood in them.
So you're feeding them to boil the water?
Yes.
What's the wood on the top for?
Oh, it's just to, because that's wet wood, we just put it up there to dry. Because we can't put, obviously, wet wood, otherwise it will put out the fire a bit. So we use dry wood and it burns better.
Okay, so is this the first time, is this the first climate camp thing that you've been to?
Yes.
What do you think of it?
I've really enjoyed it so far, and I'm definitely going to come next year, because I really enjoy it. I've made loads of new friends, and it's been really fun.
Alright, wicked. And which neighbourhood are you staying in?
In London. London.
Okay, is there anyone you want to say hello to?
Probably my mum and my dad.
Okay, thanks for talking to us.
Alright, you're welcome.
These are unique times on the Hoo Peninsula. My officers have a very, very difficult and complex operation.
Campaigners say they'll press ahead with a day of mass action tomorrow against plans for a new coal-fired power station at King's North.
Well, if we believe that anybody has a boat or another craft that they want to use to take part in that flotilla, we will seize it.
Welcome, this is the Climate Camp Media Review for Friday the 8th of August. It's me, John, and I've got Genevieve here as well, from Rise Up Radio Nottingham. We will be having you listening to some collected bits from the media's coverage of the camp.
Today we found some articles in national newspapers, interviews on regional radio, and pieces from local rags, most of which are either about extended stop and search powers for police or the up-and-coming day of action tomorrow.
We'll start off with a short article by the Kent Messenger with news on the camp's crayon situation.
Liberal Democrats replace Climate Camp crayons. Metway Liberal Democrat councillor Andy Stamp has stepped in to replace some of the items which police allegedly confiscated during raids on the Climate Camp. Police took away several items which they thought had the potential to be used in criminal acts. Items seized included chalk, crayons, marker pens and a board game. Councillor Stamp said, "When the police took away these items, many of the children camping on the site had no toys to play with or crayons to draw pictures with. So the Lib Dems did a quick election and purchased paper, crayons, chalk and a few games. It was great to be able to present the children with the equipment. They looked really pleased to have their crayons back." He also added that the police behaviour had been very disappointing. "They have been totally inconsistent in their approach to seizing items, depending on which police shift is on patrol. How can they justify this petty confiscation?"
And now, our regular feature, where FTP fires off at the press.
In a piece in The Guardian today, activist Joss Garman notes that despite abundant evidence of the need to act now on climate change, media coverage of the camp fails to connect the evidence to the activities of the camp, and that thus, we end up with two possible stories. The front page banner, "Dangerous anarchists threaten chaos," or tucked away at the back of the paper, "Peaceful protest passes without incident." In part, he attributes this to the media frenzy focusing on the same old soap opera personality politics. And, indeed, today we see Scargill giving his first media interview in a decade in The Independent, whose editorial has a puppet Scargill, while Scargill has a puppet Mumbio in The Guardian CIF, and several papers carry reports of a letter that Caroline Lucas MEP and MPs Norman Baker and Colin Challen have written to the Kent Police criticising the extension of stop and search powers and the subsequent undermining of civil liberties. Only a handful of news sites are even reporting on the camp today. And those that do still tend to give uncritical rehashes of police smears and Eon's greenwash about clean coal and carbon capture. Garmin reminds us that every report repeats the myth that the proposed new power station would be a cleaner coal plant. No one reports that in fact this coal plant will pollute as much as more than 30 developing countries combined. That there will be no use of carbon capture and storage, CCS technology, and that the plant will be so inefficient as to waste half of all the energy it creates.
So, a fair bit of media attention has been given to the announcement by Kent Police to extend stop and search powers by rolling out a Section 60 across the Hoo Peninsula. Of course, in the media was the first to break the story, but BBC followed the next morning.
MPs concerned at climate policing. BBC News, Friday the 8th of August. An extension of police powers to stop and search anyone near a protest camp in Kent is undermining civil liberties, two MPs and an MEP have said. South East MEP Caroline Lucas and MPs Norman Baker and Colin Challen have written to the Kent force with concerns about the policing of the protest.
Here we've got another bit that was featured on BBC Radio this morning.
Police claim they're still finding people carrying items that could be used as weapons, but Caroline Lucas says there's no reasonable grounds for doing this.
I think it is undermining our civil liberties, and at the moment at least there's absolutely no reasonable grounds to be doing that. It's obviously disrupting lives of people all around that area in a very unnecessary way. I would also argue that it's undermining the legitimate right to protest. I've written to the European Commission asking them to look at that. There is a human right to legitimately and peacefully protest, and I think there are times when that is an absolutely right thing to do, and the police seem to be making it impossible for people to carry out that basic right. So I think there are a number of key civil liberty issues here.
And it seems Caroline Lucas wasn't just busy attending to the various media requests yesterday. In the New Statesman, she writes an article arguing that the police's approach on policing is a bid to provoke breaches of the peace.
Other than that, and an article in The Economist on the choice between coals and renewables, we find only a few articles. It seems the national press is more interested in the opening of the Olympics in Beijing.
So, this brings us to the end of today's media review. A shout out again to Doug for providing us with most of the media coverage and the extract from the BBC article, and FDP for enlightening us again on journalists' wicked ways. We'll leave you with an extract from BBC Radio this morning. So for now, good day and auf Wiedersehen.
On the subject of the, there's some interesting bits in the national press about this. In the Independent today, there's a long interview with Arthur Scargill, who's at the camp, talking about, and I suppose you might think he's a slightly strange bedfellow. He supports coal being used to generate electricity, not surprisingly, as the former leader of the National Union of Coal Miners. He also says that carbon capture is the solution, although it's an untested, untried, unproven technology up to now, but he says that's the answer, and that by the time the new King's North is built, he believes that that technology will be available. And interesting, on the front page of The Guardian today, slightly tongue-in-cheek I suspect, he challenges George Monbiot, who we spoke to on his programme a couple of days ago. He's the Guardian reporter who's at the camp as well. And he says, I challenge George Monbiot to test out which is the most dangerous fuel, coal or nuclear power. He says, Arthur Scargill says, I'm prepared to go into a room full of CO2 for 2 minutes if he's prepared to go into a room full of radiation for 2 minutes. Anyway, it's a gauntlet thrown down which is unlikely to be picked up, one suspects.
When first I enlisted, I thought it an honour. Injustice to fight and the peace to maintain. Now I'm standing here like some glorified bollard, once more at the gates on the road to Faslane. Each morning we come here to block the blockaders, defending a terror deployed in our name. Folk who joined the police to make the world safer now paid to stop other folk doing the same. But if there can be WMD here in Scotland, why not in Korea? Why not in Iran? The world's greatest war crimes just waiting to happen. And we're standing here to make sure that it can. With hospitals failing and street stabbings daily, and climate change staying at the top of the news, Westminster still wants a wedge out of my wages to spend on a weapon they never can use. And if they should use them, what is there to say? And how to square that with where I stand today? I'm just 23 and I want to have children. I'll not keep the peace for them, please, in this way. So I whipped out my cuffs and locked onto a lorry. My colleagues all staring like I was insane. Then one by one slowly they broke ranks to join me. On the PC-365 blockade of Faslane, reached for their mobiles, broadcasting the news to the planet at large, where the statement I issued was widely reported. For health and for safety, we had to take charge. Me, and millions applaud me, and medals applaud me for letting them live. When the daydream was woke by words harshly spoken, saying, look alive, 365, time to change shift.
Alright, so we're back, and we're here with the Climate Camp All-Stars. They're going to bring us a few tracks. I don't think we've ever had as many musicians in one tent at the same time. We've got trumpets, we've got all sorts. I'm sure you'll hear it all later. Just before we go into that, I just want to tell you that this Climate Camp Radio is brought to you by Dissident Island, Rise Up Radio, Flash Radio, PlentyFact.net, IndieMedia UK, and Wireless Bristol Wireless. So now I'm going to let them take it away.
Yes.
And sing the night away.
Taking it away and bringing it back. So we're doing a few numbers out on the street tomorrow, and bringing our soulful resistance to the streets of this locality. And this is one of the tunes we're doing. It's it goes a bit like this.
If I'm not mistaken.
Soul power, not core power. We ain't gonna burn it up.
putting out the fossil fuel fires and keeping our souls fires. Something's turning. Oh yeah.
People powered up, so-called power.
People powered up, power.
People powered up, called power. Power nut, coal power. Power nut, coal power. Gonna burn it up. Yeah, we're putting out the coal fires and keeping our soul fires burning. Soul fires, something's turning. Soul fires burning. What we're gonna do?
Oh yeah!
Oh, in the back of the world, yeah. Sing it.
Fire,
shut 'em down.
Let's hear it for Climate Camp Orchestra. Woo! Round of applause. We were hoping for a second track, but unfortunately, due to a few restraints on time and resources, we are going to have to leave it at that for tonight's show. So again, we want to thank all our guests who've come in. We've had loads of very interesting people on. We've all learnt lots again today. Tomorrow's a big day of action, so you guys are certainly going to help keep people marching, keep feet moving, keep spirits up, and it's going to be